Hello and welcome to Airline Pilot Guy, episode number 51, part 2. As you can probably tell, this is a little bit different sound than you normally hear from me. I'm using my iPhone's built-in microphone. And the reason for that is that, as I started to record all of the different segments for this particular podcast, I didn't realize how long, and you know me, I can talk forever. I didn't realize how long this thing was going. And when I was doing the editing today at my mom's bedside in her nursing home room, one of the reasons why I'm out here in California, I realized that the show was going to end up being just shy of 3 hours long. Now, I know many of you have said, hey, you know, we like the long podcasts, but I'm thinking, you know, 2 hours and 45 minutes, that's a little excessive. So I made a command decision here that I would split up these episodes. And I know that a lot of you don't like the, multi-part episodes, but I just thought this would be a good compromise. So if you've already listened to the Airline Pilot Guy Part 1, you know that I was in the middle of answering your feedback. And so we're going to go ahead and continue with your feedback, and that'll pretty much take up the rest of the show. So hope everybody's doing well. Thanks for hanging in there with me, and hopefully we'll be on a normal production schedule sometime soon. Thanks.
Okay, I'm back. I have a fresh, what do you call this, stein of beer. And I'm ready to go with some more of your feedback. Here is Evan.
G'day, Captain Jeff. My name's Evan. I'm a recreational pilot down here in Australia. I fly the Australian-made Jabiru and also the Italian-made Technam Sierra. I think in America you'd probably call me a sport pilot. I just wanted to send you some feedback regarding your shorter length episodes. I prefer your normal longer length ones because I found that the short ones, you're actually a little rushed. I prefer your usual unhurried and deliberate meter when you're...
What are you talking about?
I listen to your podcast on my commute to work, which is about an hour and a quarter, so I've got plenty of time to listen to podcasts. Thank you for answering my question, even though you didn't know it, about the strakes. I was looking up pictures of the MD-88, MD-90 on the internet, and noticed the strakes. Was about to send you some feedback and ask you about them when you already did. So yes, thank you very much for answering my question. My question for you today is, have you ever experienced the joy of introducing a new person to aviation? So someone that's never really been in even a small aircraft or anything like that, and get to watch their reaction as you take off and fly over local features and land. And yeah, I've been flying now for 2 years and I'm starting to really enjoy sharing it with my friends and family. So I was just wondering if you had any thoughts or stories, experiences, maybe in a similar way. Thank you very much for your podcast. Please enjoy the couple of coffees that I sent you, and will look forward to many more podcasts in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Evan, for sending your feedback, and thank you for your contribution to my quote-unquote coffee fund. And does that mean I can't buy beer with it? We'll have to see. Anyway, great question regarding, I've never heard of a Jabiru. I love the sound of that, Jabiru. Maybe you can send me a picture of a Jabiru. Or, of course, I could just go to Google and Google it myself. Regarding the experience of being with somebody who has or is experiencing flying for the first time, I can I guess the closest that I've had to that experience is when I was an instructor pilot in the Air Force, U.S. Air Force. I flew the T-37, which is the first jet trainer that a potential Air Force pilot will fly. Well, when they get into the regular undergraduate pilot training program, they may have had the opportunity to fly a T-41 Muscadero, or which is a 172, or something like that, before they make it to the regular undergraduate pilot training. And I guess now, that's not even true. Present day U.S. Air Force pilot trainees start off with a T-6 Texan or something like that, the new version. I'm not sure, but I think they finally put to rest all the T-37s in the inventory. Great airplane, by the way. I flew that as an instructor, and you know, when I got tagged to return to the Air Training Command, I was flying in the MAC, the Military Airlift Command. That was my initial assignment out of pilot training, and I got this notice that I was being considered to return to the Air Training Command as an instructor. Wasn't really that happy about that, because at the time I thought that was going to be like the death knell for my airline career. I didn't know at the time that it didn't really make that much of a difference. But when I learned that I was going to return to the Air Training Command on a non-volunteer basis, I realized that I could fly the T-37 or the T-38. Now, the T-38 is the beer is making me burp. My bad. The T-38 is a high-performance supersonic, barely supersonic jet trainer. Beautiful airplane. What a lot of fun to fly. Probably the most scared, I think I've mentioned this before, probably the most scared I've ever been in my life in an airplane, the T-38, in a four-ship extended trail maneuver several times. But when I knew that I was going to be coming back as an instructor pilot, I thought that I would get greater satisfaction, even though the airplane's not as cool and not as fast, not as capable to fly. But I knew that the experience of working with men and women, or really boys and girls, who have never flown in a jet, and some of whom have never or hardly ever even flown in an airplane. I think at that time, most of the people that made it through or to undergraduate pilot training had at least a private pilot's license, or you know, some experience in a single engine, a general aviation kind of airplane. Some had more experience, of course, but some of them had very, very little experience. Like I was one of those people. I had very little experience. By the time I started undergraduate pilot training, I probably had about a total of 20 hours in my logbook. Yes, you heard me correctly. 20 hours. And there were times that we actually did a program, in the summertime where, people would be introduced to flying for the very first time in a program where we'd take them up in the T-37, fly them around the pattern a few times, maybe go out to the area, do a little bit of very, very light, acrobatics and that kind of thing. Cause we didn't want to, you know, make them sick. And the only way that I could experience the thrill of that flight for them is to hear them, because, you know, when you're in the T-37, you're wearing a parachute and you're wearing a helmet and you're wearing an oxygen mask and a visor, and you really can't see the people. And you're sitting, you know, even though you're sitting right next to them, you really can't see the expressions on their faces, but you can hear their excitement in their voices. And a lot of times it wasn't positive excitement. It was, you could tell it was tinged with a little bit of fear, because even though the T-37 is not a supersonic airplane, it's still, you know, it's a jet. It's a twin engine Air Force jet that has the capability of pulling a lot of G forces. And so you got to be careful with it. But yeah, I had a fun time taking up people that had never really flown hardly at all. And especially the people that were just starting undergraduate pilot training, and being able to mold these people into real jet pilots was quite rewarding. And that's the reason, to go full circle here, that I picked the T-37 over the T-38. I could have flown the T-38. I could have been a T-38 instructor pilot. By that time, when you move to the T-38 side of things, you've got about 75, 80 hours, I think, under your belt, maybe closer to 100 hours. So you have a little bit of experience with flying and acrobatics and formation flying and a little bit of instrument navigation flying. And so it's not that new to you. What's new to you is the high-performance aspect of flying. So, again, and the other thing I liked about the T-37 was that, you know, cross-country flights, whether you're flying with a student or a fellow instructor, which is really dangerous, you could fly pretty much into any airport because you didn't require really anything. You were basically a self-contained unit. All you required was a place that had a contract with the military for fuel, jet fuel, and that's it. Now, the T-38, it was like a diva. With the T-38, you had to make sure that the base that you flew into or the airport that you flew into had an air start unit. It had a, what else do we need? Yeah, like several different things, like an electrical generator unit, an air start unit, all this kind of stuff. And the cool thing about the T-38 cross-country is that you could go further distances, but, you know, you were limited to where you could go. It was basically go to a military base. And the cool thing about the T-37 is you could go anywhere, and that was a lot of fun. Okay, enough of that. So thank you, Evan, for your question regarding new pilots and their reactions. And, yeah, it's always fun to kind of share the experience with people for the first time, especially those who have a true passion for flying. Okay, in an earlier podcast, I had mentioned something about, or somebody had called in about girls with, no, I talked about women flying. And Mark Labrowski, you know, the guy that critiques my what I'm doing right now, anyway, and Mark, I know, I owe you many, many beers, and I look forward to the time that we can spend together in the Charlotte area and catching up on things. And I always appreciate all your feedback. Well, he writes to me, "Hi Jeff, your youngest listener Hannah may be interested in www.girlswithwings.com. Linda Meeks, the founder of this wonderful organization, is an accomplished pilot and does a great job of supporting women in aviation and getting young girls interested in flying careers. Hope you had a great holiday, Mark." And thank you, Mark Labrowski, for that. So that, again, that's www.girlswithwings.com. Again, I'll hope to have that in our show notes. So if you have a young lady that you're that you know, or a daughter, that maybe that's a potential place to go to get them interested in aviation. Also, I saw this in AvWeb. I get a little email from them a couple times a week. A gift with wings. Gift stands for Girls in Flight Training Gift. What compelled 45 women from Anchorage to Chesterfield, New Hampshire, to trek to Vernon, Texas, a tiny North Texas town where there are more trucks than cars? All had heard about a unique program called Girls in Flight Training Academy that provides free ground and flight instruction for women in all stages of flight training. The second annual event was held November 3rd through the 10th at the Will Barger County Airport. According to Patty Shannon, the promise of free flight training was certainly a big draw, but she and many others were in pursuit of something that can't be logged. "I needed a serious boost of confidence," said Shannon, who soloed at Gift and plans to finish her private pilot certificate by year end. "Flying is something I've always dreamed of doing. I just needed an environment where everything seemed possible. Being among such a supportive, encouraging group of women was truly priceless." priceless. So very, very cool. Great program out there in Vernon, Texas, North Texas. Gift. And I think I'll have a... I don't see the link right offhand, but you can always do a Google search for GIFT. That is pretty amazing. Free training? Man, that's unheard of, isn't it? It's expensive. So if you're a female and you're interested in flying, check out the GIFT program. This from John in Minneapolis. Greetings, Captain Jeff. Hey, I've heard from you before, John. Here he is again. Okay, I just finished listening to Airline Pilot Guy episode 50, where you talked about lightning strikes on airplanes. It seems that your timing was perfect. The Aviation Herald reports that an airplane over the Adriatic Sea near Croatia was hit by lightning on November 28th and had to be taken out of service for repairs. And he has a link to that Aviation Herald article. I also have a few aviation-related questions and one comment. Question 1. Why do the flight attendants turn off the cabin lights prior to takeoff? Is this to conserve power on the airplane so there is less load on the engines? Or is it a safety thing so that the passengers have a better view out the windows in the event of an incident? Okay, you know what? He has two more questions here. But before I answer those two questions, John, just for you, I called up an expert because I wasn't sure of the answer. And I wanted to make sure I was going to give you the right answer. And so I called up my friend, Marcia West, who she and I and Father Roderick were co-hosts in a program, a podcast, a show called The Secrets of Pan Am. Do you remember that ABC program that lasted a year and thankfully they put to death? it had so much potential, but they just took it in the completely wrong direction. The writers, well, I don't want to go into this, but we did this podcast talking about the show, the ABC program, the drama, Pan Am, and one of the co-hosts on the show was Marcia West. She is an ACME flight attendant, a professional flight attendant, and I called up Marcia, asked her to answer John's question about the lighting. So without further ado, here is our conversation. Okay, here's Marcia. And Marcia, I was telling the listeners that John in Minneapolis sent me some feedback, and he had three questions, and one of them was one that I really didn't know the answer to, and I thought, well, who better than you to ask the question? So here goes. Why do the flight attendants turn off the cabin lights prior to takeoff? Is this to conserve power on the airplane so there is less load on the engines? Or is it a safety thing so that the passengers have a better view out the windows in the event of an incident?
Well, first of all, thank you for the question, John. That's a great question. Other than the obvious reason, that would be to enhance the beauty of the flight attendants, that you are correct. The natural lighting for takeoff and landing is much better on the eyes. Fluorescent lighting, as you know, on an airplane is very, in my opinion, unnatural, and it's very bright and harsh. So we are asked to dim the cabin lights for takeoff and landing just so that you can see outside and that your eyes can adjust more quickly to the natural things that are going on around you.
Okay, so I thought it was because if we had the lights on, there wouldn't be enough power in the engines to get the airplane airborne.
Well, you know, we like to make people think that. So we like to let the pilots know that we do have a little bit of power back in the back of the cabin behind the cockpit door. So, you know, if we turned on the lights full power, I'm not sure we could get off the runway.
Okay. Well, thank you for that explanation, because I was telling Marcia earlier that one of the channels that I monitor on the interphone radio panel that I listen to in my head, so I have all these voices talking to me. That's in addition to the other voices that talk to me, which I don't really want to talk about here. But one of the channels is the PA channel, and I noticed that, you know, listening as we were taxiing out for takeoff, I hear you all a lot of times saying, you know, we're going to be dimming the cabin lights, and even during the daytime, I hear you say that, and I'm thinking, well, what's the difference? You know, it doesn't seem like that that would make any difference at all during the daytime. Is it just because that's your habit of saying that, or is there a difference?
There's a big difference. I know that you go cross country a lot, just pass riding, mm-hmm. and you know how we do keep the lights off. Like I said before, the fluorescent lighting is very unnatural. I think the dimmer the lights, the calmer the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
The only time they ask us to use bright lights is for boarding, deplaning, and during emergency situations when we have to get information to the passengers.
Okay.
Every other time we are to dim the lights appropriate to the time of day. And, if you have an all-night flight back from the West Coast and you're leaving there at midnight and everybody's asleep, of course, you want all the lights out as dim as possible just so folks can sleep. But that's the only time we use the bright lights is for those reasons. So we dim the lights for takeoff and landing. So your natural vision can adjust to what's outside.
Okay. So the main reason, of course, is safety then.
That's yes, why always.
Okay. Hey, now I have a question for you. I just flew out from Atlanta to John Wayne, Santa Ana, SNA. And it was a long flight. I'm glad I don't do those all the time. It was like just under 5 hours. But I guess for you, if you're doing a turnaround, which these Atlanta-based ACME flight attendants were doing, it's a pretty decent trip for you, under 10 hours. But anyway, the thing I noticed about this, and I've noticed this all the time, either when I'm deadheading or when I'm flying as a passenger, and it doesn't matter whether I'm wearing a uniform or not, the people around me don't seem to pay any attention at all to the usage of electronic devices. Now, for those listening to this podcast, they know what my stance is regarding electronic devices. Personally, honestly, I don't think they make any difference at all as far as safety is concerned, as far as affecting the aircraft navigation systems or anything else. And I think that it's going to be sooner rather than later that they're going to be overturning that ban below 10,000 feet that we have now. But to me, it's more of if it's a rule, then darn it, you should be paying attention to that. And there may be other reasons besides, interfering with the aircraft electronics and such.
Let me tell you what our issue is, the flight attendant issue with electronic devices is when you're entranced in any kind of electronic game, text, whatever you're doing, you're totally focused on that. You are not focused on anything else around you. So they tend to not pay attention to announcements, safety demonstrations. I'm on a beverage cart going down the aisle. I have beverages on top of my cart. I have ice, I have water, coffee. I look at somebody with a headset on, it's watching TV, and I say something to him, and of course they can't hear me. He takes off his headsets and looks at me like, "What?
What?"
Like, "Why do you think I'm standing here, fool?"
I'm asking for your phone number.
that's really even more so than using them for takeoff and landing. It's the fact that they're so – you can only really concentrate on one thing at a time. And being on an airplane, things turn on a dime. I've had that happen with medical emergencies, all kind of stuff. And you know as well as I do that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And with electronic devices and with all the things that we have and we can do now, it's very hard to get everyone's attention.
Yeah.
And that's really what the major problem is with the electronic devices. It's not the fact that I think they have decided that it's really not a navigation issue with the airplane. It's for us, it's more about you're just not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
And I might be saying something you need to know.
Well, I'm always paying attention to you, especially when you're speaking, Marcia.
Thanks.
So, as I was going to say, I look around me and people are putting they're not turning their phones off. They're not even putting them into, airplane only mode, and they're only turning them off. Some people don't even feign trying to turn it off and put it away as you're walking by. It's just this guy sitting next to me, I wanted to look at him. Are you a 5-year-old? I mean, she just told you to turn off your.
I want to say that all the time.
Gosh. Anyway, so how many devices do you think, honestly, are on a typical, let's say, 150 passenger airplane, constantly on, never get turned off?
All of them.
All of them. Well, I wouldn't say all of them. I think
90%,
they're. I think that. 80%, yeah.
more on than off.
Yeah, I think you're right. At least half the people that have electronic devices with them probably have them on. So, oh well. But hey, that was a great explanation. I thank you for that. And Marcia, thank you for taking your time or the time out of your day to answer that question, or a couple of questions I had actually for you. And hey, if you're listening to Marcia and you have any questions that may be better answered from a flight attendant's point of view, send them in. And you know how to do that. feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. Thanks again, Marcia.
You're very welcome, Captain Jeff. I hope to speak with you soon.
Me too. Take care.
Okay.
Bye. Thanks again, Marcia, for answering that question for me. And hey, folks, if you're interested in hearing more from Marcia and her answers to questions related to the happenings behind the cockpit door, the other side of the cockpit door from which I'm on, send in your questions and maybe she can become a regular part of our show. So let's move on with John in Minneapolis's two other questions. Question number two, have you ever needed to use the thrust reversers to push the airplane back from the gate instead of having a tractor push the airplane back? Okay, I have used reverse as a co-pilot. We had to do that once in Boise because the conditions, the snow on the ground and everything, were such that the tug was having some trouble getting traction to push the airplane back. So, but we weren't specifically or exclusively using reverse thrust to back from the gate at that time, but we did kind of assist the tug. I believe the policy now, at least with ACME, is that, you have to get special permission from flight operations before we use reverse in any situation to propel the airplane in a reverse direction. There are and have been airlines in the past who routinely used reverse thrust to back out or push back from the gate. AirTran being one of them that I remember in the recent past, and they're not doing that anymore. I believe that all their pushbacks are performed by tugs or tractors. But it wasn't that long ago, just a few years ago, that it was a routine thing to see the Boeing 717s, and I don't know if they had DC-9s at that time or not, but to use reverse thrust. I've never seen a wing-mounted engine airplane ever use reverse thrust to back out from a gate, but I have seen a rear-mounted engine airplanes like the DC-9, the MD-80 series airplanes use it. Just a side story, my wife, knowing my propensity for every time I've actually bent metal in a car has been when I've been backing up. And when she was asking about my hiring process, my interviewing process, with the airlines, she said, honey, do you have to back the airplane up out of the gate? And I said, no, luckily ACME doesn't use that procedure. And she goes, oh, good, because she was fearful that I was going to back an airplane into another airplane or hit a building or something. But so, no, ACME does not routinely use thrust reversers. In fact, very rarely uses thrust reversers to push airplanes back. Well, we just don't do this. Not a policy. So, no. Number three, how do the jet engines get started? Are they spun up by electrical or electric motors until enough air is flowing through them to ignite the jet fuel? Hey, that's a great question, John. And I'd say 99% of airplanes, the airplanes out there, the traditional airplanes that use bleed air for powering the air conditioning packs, the pressurization systems and that kind of thing, they use air, bleed air, well, just pressurized air to spin the engine core to a certain speed before fuel and ignition is applied to the equation. And at that point, the engine ignites and it starts on its own. However, there is an exception, at least one, the 787, which I talked about earlier. It's an electric airplane for the most part, and generators on the 787 are also starters, and so they act to spin the airplane's motors up to a certain speed, and then fuel and ignition is introduced, and then the engines start providing power on their own. But that, again, is an exception. Most airplanes, when they start, are not started using electrical power. They're using pneumatics or air, pressurized air, to start spinning the core of the engine to a certain speed. So that is my answer for how most turbine engines are started. As always, your podcast is one of the best ones out there. Keep up the great work. Thanks, John. Always appreciate your kind comments and your great questions. Hi, Captain Jeff. Like always, I enjoy your podcast. I was at KDFW, Dallas-Fort Worth, where there happens to be a boatload of MD-80s taking off and landing all day. Those MD-80s climb like bats out of hell. They really impressed me, so I decided to find more information on the aircraft you fly. There's lots of good information on the internet. While looking for this information, I came across a very interesting webpage that I would like to share with you, www.smartcockpit.com. This webpage has lots of interesting information, like aircraft flight manuals and flying techniques for many commercial and corporate jets. Anyway, I hope you find this page of interest. Keep up the good work. And this is from David in Mexico City. Thanks, David. Yeah, I checked out smartcockpit.com, and you're right. It is it's an amazing wealth of information regarding all kinds of airplanes out there, manuals and stuff like that, flying techniques. So you should check it out too. Smartcockpit.com. Thanks again, David. And let's go over here, back over to the Southern Hemisphere, to, I believe, Australia. Here, let me see. Let me click on Matt's voice feedback.
Hi, Captain Jeff. It's just here from Matt here from Brisbane, Australia. I know you wanted me to send you some voicemail because you liked the Aussie accents. So this is what I'm doing now. Basically, I've got a question about airline alliances. I don't know if ACMI is in one or not. I'm pretty sure they are, but I'm not too sure. I'm just wanting to know what they do really for passengers, for pilots, and for everyone involved, if they're good or if they're bad, or if they don't really mean anything or do anything. That's all I really wanted to ask at the moment. That's about it. I'll just tell you about myself. Just doing my CPL at the moment. Got my meteorology exam next week, so hopefully I pass that. And it's going pretty well at the moment. I've read the book about 5-6 times, so I should be pretty ready for it. I know most stuff, so hopefully I pass that. And, yeah, I'm just doing my CPL at the moment. Should take me about another 6 months and I'll have that. And then I get to go find a job. Yay. Which should be good. Hope you can answer my question. And thank you. See you soon.
Well, thanks, Maddie, for your feedback. And, yeah, love those accents. And I hope by now you've already had your meteorology exam. I hope you did well. I'm sure you aced it. And, thanks for your feedback. So, you asked about airline alliances and what the heck are they and what good are they? So, I looked at the Wikipedia, well, the new Wikipedia, about airline alliances. Now, ACMI is part of an alliance, as are many major airlines around the world. And an airline alliance is an agreement between two or more airlines, usually more, to cooperate on a substantial level. The three largest passenger alliances are the Star Alliance, SkyTeam, and One World. Alliances also form between cargo airlines, such as that of WOW Alliance, WOW, SkyTeam Cargo, and ANA/UPS Alliance. Alliances provide a network of connectivity and convenience for international passengers and international packages. Alliances also provide convenient marketing branding to facilitate travelers making inter-airline code share connections within countries. This branding goes as far as to even include unified aircraft liveries among member airlines. Now, a livery is the paint scheme of an airline. So, the benefits of an alliance are an extended network. This is often realized through code sharing agreement. Now, code sharing agreement, or sometimes just simply call it code share, is an aviation business arrangement where two or more airlines share the same flight. So sometimes at ACME will be ACME Flight 451, also operating as Korean Airlines Flight so-and-so, or Alaska Air 542, or whatever. So you may be traveling from Juneau to Washington, D.C., and you may actually show up at the airport in Juneau and fly on Alaska, whatever, to Seattle. And then from Seattle to Washington, you might actually be on a United Airlines flight. Now, I'm making that up because I know that Alaska is not, doesn't have a code share agreement with Alaska. They do with ACME, though. So even though your ticket says Alaska flight, blah, 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 you are actually on a flight on a different airline because they are sharing the same code. You know, codes are those two-letter codes for an airline. For example, United Airlines is UA. Alaska is WN. No, I'm sorry, that's Southwest. I'm not sure what Alaska is. I forgot. Delta is DL. Whatever. So we have different two-letter codes for each of the major airlines, and then if we share a code, that means that we operate the flight as a bunch of different flight numbers based on whatever airline is sharing that code. And that gives the airlines more flexibility to operate to places where it doesn't actually have flights going, but it can kind of sell a ticket as if it were actually flying to that destination. So getting back to an alliance, many alliances started only as codeshare agreements, but alliances cost benefit from cost reductions because they can share sales offices, maintenance facilities, operational facilities like catering and computer systems, operational staff like ground handling personnel at check-in and boarding desks, also ground ramp agents and you know, the people that bring you in to park and that kind of thing. So you might be flying on Swiss Air, but they actually may be using a different airline's ground crew to handle them on the ground. Let's see, travelers benefit because the prices are lower due to lowered operational costs for a given route, more departure times to choose from on a given route, more destinations within an easy reach, shorter travel times as a result of optimized transfers, a wider range of airport lounges shared with alliance members, faster mileage rewards by earning miles for a single account on several different carriers, and round-the-world tickets enabling travelers to fly over the world over the world for a relatively low price. They can also be a disadvantage for the traveler, such as higher prices when all competition is basically erased on a certain route. And it also could result in less frequent flights. For instance, if two airlines separately fly 3 and 2 times a day, respectively, on a shared route, their alliance might fly less than 5 times 3+2 times a day on the same route. So this might be especially true between hub cities for each airline. For example, flights between Detroit, Delta Airlines Fortress Hub, and Amsterdam, a KLM Fortress Hub. So alliances aren't always a good deal for the traveler, but I think in most cases it is. And it's definitely a good deal for the participating airlines. So I hope I answered your question thoroughly, Matt from Brisbane. By the way, I've actually landed once in my life in Brisbane. That was the first time I actually saw a real koala. No, it was a koala. Is that what those bear, those animals are? Koala bear. Yeah, it's a koala bear. I saw one when we had a little bit of a fuel taking on layover in Brisbane before we headed over to Darwin back in my Air Force days.
Good morning, Trina.
Good morning, Captain Whitaker.
Here's your manifest with 102 souls on board.
Let's get them tucked in. We're ready to push.
Hi, Captain Jeff. Here are a couple of questions for you. Could the makers of the movie Flight have been thinking of the following line from the Alaska Airlines 261 CVR transcript when they decided to invert their fictional plane? And this is from the transcripts, 1620 colon 38, camera one, or cam one. Got to get it over again, at least upside down, we're flying. What's going on here? Here's a link to the report with the transcript. Yes, that is, from what I know, Mike from New York City, the inspiration that, or the at least the incident that the writers, the developers, the producers of the movie Flight used for the setup event of the movie. I did see it, by the way. And overall, I think it's a pretty good movie. That's rated R, and I agree with some of the people who have given me feedback about the movie regarding the overuse of or unnecessary use of nudity at the beginning of the show. It is rated R, but again, I think you could have easily told the story of the movie without the gratuitous nudity at the beginning. Yes, the setup to the movie Flight was based on the Alaska Airlines Flight 261 that crashed off of the Southern California coastline. And in the transcript, which is really hard to read every time I do, it just gives me a stomach ache. This is the incident where the Acme nut actually was stripped of its threads and slid up off of the Acme jack screw, and basically the stabilizer, the horizontal stabilizer, became jammed in the full down position. At one point during the event that eventually led to the tragic death of everybody on board, the pilots were able to fly the airplane inverted for a short period of time. And then something happened after that that resulted in a not-so-positive end. And I do believe that the people that wrote the movie or wrote the screenplay for the movie Flight used that as the setup event. Of course, the movie really is a drama about the captain, the pilot's alcoholism, and the fact that he had to come to grips with the fact that he was an alcoholic. So, as far as a review of the thing, should you go see it? Yeah, I think it's not a bad movie. Denzel Washington is a good actor, and he does a great performance. If you're somebody who knows a little bit about aviation, you're going to be probably put off by the fact that there are some incredulous things that happen with the airplane, like the inverted flying scene. And of course, I think the worst part was the it crashes in this field, and as soon as it touches the ground, it basically comes to a stop almost in just a few feet. Now, an airplane that is traveling at that speed would never, you know, come to a stop that quickly. So, you know, that's not real. But again, I don't think it really matters for the basic theme of the music or the movie. And the other thing that was a little off-putting to me was the fact that at some point during the hearings toward the end of the film, the co-pilot is saying, yeah, you know, the captain came on into the cockpit and he was so full of gin, or, you know, he basically was saying he was so drunk and he realized it. And that, if that were the case, if a captain walked into the cockpit, if he was able to make it that far, and the co-pilot knew or sensed that the other crew member was under the influence of alcohol, he would leave the cockpit. He would not fly that flight. It would never have happened. That would never have taken off. So, but other than that, good film. So I recommend that you see it. Okay. The second thing that Mike from New York City says is, I was aboard a 777 landing at JFK when I noticed that the seat back altitude display, which seemed to give more or less real-time indications foot by foot, barely registered turbulence that set flight attendants scrambling for their to their jump seats and at least one passenger into a preemptive crash position. You? Mike? We were between 5,000 and 6,000 feet following some mid-September thunderstorms. Are these swoops and swells actually that subtle? When we're riding a roller coaster back in the cabin, what's really happening on your altimeter up in the cockpit? Many thanks for your thoughts on these and for the terrific podcast. All the best, Mike from New York City. Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mike. Yes, surprisingly, and that's why pilots always look at these reports. Oh, the airplane, you know, the passengers say, well, the airplane dropped 1,000 feet or 3,000 feet in the, quote, air pocket. And we always shake our heads saying, well, no, not really. When you go through some turbulence, and I'm talking about significant turbulence, the altitude hardly changes at all. I mean, we're talking, you know, tens of feet, maybe 20 feet, maybe 30 feet. And actually, that's the reason why it feels so bad, because the autopilot is almost always connected. And the autopilot, when you tell it to fly a certain altitude, it's captured a level altitude, it is going to do everything it can do to maintain that altitude. And so when you get into turbulent air, or the speed is, airspeed is changing, dropping or increasing, the airplane is going to do, again, as I said, everything it can to maintain that barometric altitude. And you really don't notice a difference. And that's why I mentioned several times during this podcast, earlier episodes, that the L-1011 was such a great airplane because the engineers designed that autopilot so that when there was a change in airspeed and you got into turbulent air, it would actually trade some altitude and it would drop maybe 100 feet, maybe 200 feet, or rise 100 or 200 feet, and not do any abrupt changes in the airspeed. And that's the reason why it was such a nice, comfortable ride. So, yeah, even though in the back it feels like you're dropping like hundreds or thousands of feet, usually what we see in our altimeter is hardly any change at all. So that is the truth of the matter. So, no. Even though your stomach is saying, we dropped thousands of feet, the altimeter says, nope, you didn't. Thanks for your question, Mike from New York City. Keep listening and keep sending in feedback.
Hey, Captain Jeff. My name is Kyle. I'm a 21-year-old guy living in D.C. I know that I want to be in your shoes someday. Up to this point in my life, I've done every odd job I can find to save up money to start taking lessons. I have just now reached the point where I have a bit of money and would like to start doing that. And I would just like to ask you, I'm a zero hour guy. What would you do if you were me trying to get to where you are now? My second question for you is, and you may or may not have heard about this, the Air France flight 562. It was a flight from Paris to the capital of Lebanon, and the flight had to divert to Syria, and the passengers were asked to pay for fuel due to the civil war that's going on in Syria right now. And I was just wondering if maybe you could provide a little commentary or analysis maybe about how or why that had to happen, which leads me into my next question. How much does it actually cost if you were to, say, fill up? You might only be able to speak for your plane, but, you know, any plane, say, from empty to full, you know, just out of curiosity, how much does that actually cost? And I understand you're not, you might not deal with that directly, but maybe at least you know someone that could help me answer that. And then maybe my fourth question for you, sorry, and my last one, is I wanted to ask you about the ETOPS protocol. You know, I've read up a bit on it online, and you talk about planes like the L-1011 and the 727. I believe that those planes had the engine on the tail to comply with this, to comply with ETOPS, and I'm just wondering if those planes falling out of service has to do with the more relaxed ETOPS regulations now since twin jets have become much more reliable. Just anything else maybe you'd like to say about that. But thank you very much. You have a wonderful podcast. I just discovered it in the process of catching up, so I apologize if any of these questions have already been asked. But clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. God bless, Captain Jeff, and thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Kyle, for your voice feedback. Appreciate it. So you asked several questions, and welcome aboard the Airline Pilot Guy Show community. Let's see, where do we start? I'm trying to remember everything that you asked. Well, first of all, good thing that you have some money now to spend on your flight training. And as far as my recommendation regarding, you know, where you go from here, I have to rely on several other people's experiences because, you know, things change over the years, cycles in the aviation industry, etc. And what was once the best way to go, let's say in the late 70s for me, and it was the military route, may not be the best route now to get into the industry as quickly as possible. Because I've talked about many, many times that the quicker that you can get into the airline industry and get established with a major carrier, you know, and get that seniority established, it's going to make a big difference in your career. With that in mind, I think that, they're essentially, in fact, that reminds me, I'm going to talk about this after I finish answering your questions, but Joe sent me, well, let's just talk about it right now. Joe Masiklat sent me some feedback, email feedback, and he said, hello, Captain Jeff. I've just recently started to listen to your podcast a couple of weeks ago and enjoy listening to it. I'm a little behind on the podcast, but have just finished listening to Airline Pilot Guy 48. I've noticed that many of your listeners often comment about the looming airline pilot shortage and wanted to comment. Before I continue, it might be easier if I give you a short background of myself. My name is Joe, and I'm a student at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Prescott, Arizona. I will be graduating this December with a BS in Aeronautical Science. I am also a CFI, CFII at Embry-Riddle, like you stated in one of your podcasts. I love aviation, and if I didn't need a place to rest my head and feed my wife and I would fly planes for free. Yeah, a lot of us kind of feel that way, but we do have bills, don't we? So, recently, as part of my degree program, I had to take an aviation capstone course, basically an all-encompassing course designed to use everything I've learned in my studies here at Embry-Riddle. In this course, I needed to research a hot topic affecting the aviation industry and write a paper about what we found out. I'm prior military and a bit older than most of the students that attend here and decided to research something that was going to affect me. A good friend and I decided to research and write about the new regulations for Part 121 and Part 135 operations. Throughout the course of our research, we were surprised at what we'd found. Many people know that there will be new regulations that will make it harder for pilots to get to the right seat of an airliner, but many don't understand the reasoning behind it. I've attached the research paper my friend Josh and I completed. If you have time, I would be honored if you'd take a look at it. The paper also includes the proposed regulation changes and tips from our conclusions pilots can take to help get them into the right seat of an airliner. There are definitely some things people can do, pilots can do, to lessen the hardship of getting the required hours. Many of the changes the FAA wants, Embry-Riddle already requires its graduates to complete if they are in the airline pilot track. Let's see, as I have done. I would also love to hear your comments on our report. I enjoy your podcast and look forward to continuing to listen to them. Thanks for your time. Okay, Joe, this is kind of a feedback within a feedback, isn't it? I briefly looked through. I haven't read the entire report in detail yet, and I do intend to do that when I get some time. But I can tell you it looks like some good work you've done there. And this is going to help me answer my question for Kyle. And if it's okay with you, I'll have to email you and make sure that this is okay. I'd like to include your at least a link or a download link to your report for people that might be interested in, you know, what you consider the best route to be to get to the right seat of an airliner. But essentially, you've distilled it to three different paths to get there. One, the collegiate route. In other words, going to a school like Embry-Riddle or many other institutions out there that offer four-year degree programs along with flying experience. And one of those, of course, you mentioned is Embry-Riddle, the one that you are attending in Prescott, Arizona. And it's not cheap. You said that in your report, approximately $282,800 to get the four-year degree plus the necessary ratings and time necessary to get hired based on the new regulations. You also mentioned that a public institution would be slightly cheaper. For example, Kansas State University, well known for their aviation program, estimates the total cost for a four-year degree plus flight costs is approximately $148,198 for out-of-state students. So, you know, it's not cheap to do it that way. But Joe makes a good point, Kyle, that to get on by, especially by a major airline, I'm not sure if the regionals require it, but you need a four-year college degree. So if you don't already have that, you didn't mention that you said you were 22, I believe, and so you may already have a four-year degree. If not, you need to, you know, get that. And in addition to the ratings required and the hours required by the airlines. So that's one route, which I believe is Joe's and his friend Josh. Their conclusion is that's the best route, the collegiate route. The next route they discussed was the military route, and it's going to take a greater requirement in time unless you get on with a reserve unit or a guard unit somewhere where you can concurrently do your obligated time in the guard or reserve unit and at the same time get hired by an airline and do both of those things, although it's going to take a bunch of your time in your life to do this. But that may be the better route to go instead of going active duty, because right now I believe you have to commit somewhere between 8 to 11 years after you receive your flight training. So quite a time commitment. So you go active duty, you will not be able to fly for the airlines until you get out of the military. So that's a long, you know, you're young, so that could still be a viable option for you. But so anyway, that's the second route that they discuss in the paper. And then the last one, which they consider the cheapest way to acquire the ATP certificate minimums, would be to attend an accelerated pilot program at a Part 141 flight school. And there are several of these around, where, and I think they cost anywhere from about $50,000 to $60,000 to well over $100,000 to get all the ratings and experience required to even get an interview with a regional or major airline. But again, you have to remember that you'll also have to continue studying to get your four-year degree. So you have to keep that in mind as well. So I will, again, ask Joe if it's okay for me to include this as a link so you can read this yourself, Kyle, and maybe that'll help with your decision making as far as what to do with your time and your money to get into my shoes, which are 9.5D, by the way. Okay. Yeah, I don't have very big feet. Okay. So that was the first question you asked, Kyle. And let's see. The second was the flight from Paris to Lebanon's capital, and they had to divert because of fighting in the Beirut area. So they diverted into Damascus, which they are, especially now, but even back when this event occurred, were in the midst of a civil war, and because they had stopped serving Air France had stopped serving that location. Some of the contracts that they had for support and getting refueled had lapsed, and so they actually did revert to asking passengers to open up their wallets to help pay for fuel to get out of there. Turns out that, and I have talked about this before in an earlier episode, Kyle, but that's okay. I don't mind talking about it again. It turns out that they actually didn't have to get any money from the passengers, and they apologized for even having made the request, but they were able to work out something to get the airliner refueled and out of there. So that was an interesting story. And then you said, well, hey, by the way, how much would it cost? So I can only speak for my airplane that I'm flying right now, the MD-88, MD-90. Total fuel capacity on my jet is 39,100 pounds. And if you divide that by 6.7 pounds per gallon, which is kind of an average fuel weight density kind of formula, you end up with 5,835 gallons. So if you had a completely empty tank, or three tanks in our case, and you filled it up with fuel, you would end up putting in about 5,835 gallons. Just quickly hit a site to see about what the price of fuel is. And of course, this is going to vary between airlines because they have all kinds of contracts, hedging or contracts and that kind of stuff, what they pay for fuel. So this may or may not be an accurate figure, but I came up with a figure of $2.87 per gallon. So if you multiply 5,835 gallons by $2.87, you get $16,748.81. So that would be a fully loaded MD-88. Now, as you probably know, we never really have empty tanks. If we do, it's not good. We always have fuel in the tanks, and we don't always fill the tanks all the way to the top because that could make the airplane too heavy to land, or just even the cost of carrying fuel around that you don't really need for a particular flight is a cost in itself. So we only put on enough fuel to get to the destination plus required fuel reserves, and then sometimes we have fuel for an alternate, destination alternate. So typically I'd say when we get fuel, it could be anywhere from, 1,000 pounds to 15,000 pounds. So, it varies as far as how many gallons are pumped into the fuel tanks of my jet. Now, of course, you go to a bigger airplane like a 777, a 747, an Airbus 330, a 380, whatever. Now you're talking about as much fuel as my airliner actually weighs. So they can put on, hundreds of thousands of pounds of fuel, especially those long range flights. So, and if you had to fill up one of those tanks, it could cost quite a large sum of money. But I hope that kind of helps kind of establish the cost of fuel. And you can see that fuel is a very large part of the operating cost of an airline flight. Okay, and then you also asked about ETOPS. Now, this is something that I learned myself by researching this because you asked the question, because I have not flown, I don't think I've ever flown an ETOPS airplane, because when I was flying overseas, I was flying in airplanes that had three or four engines. And until 2007, ETOPS was only applied to airplanes with two engines. And so I think the acronym actually stood for Extended Operations. Let's see where I'm trying to find the article. Extended Range Operations with Two Engine Airplanes. And it applied to twin jets only. That was prior to 2007. So all the airplanes out there with three or four engines weren't affected by this rule. But in 2007, the Federal Aviation Administration redefined the ETOPS rule, and now it applies to all airplanes other than, or at least all passenger-carrying airplanes, whether you have two engines, three engines, four engines, whatever, and various rules within the rule apply based on the number of engines, etc. So you could be an ETOPS certified for 180 minutes, might be an ETOPS airplane certified for a different amount of time. And so essentially now the way the ETOPS is defined applies to, as I said, twin-engine airplanes like the Airbus 300, 310, 320, 330, and 350, the Boeing 737, 757, 767, 777, 787, and the Embraer E-Jets and the ATR-72 to fly long-distance routes that were previously off-limits to twin-engine aircraft. And they allow, the ETOPS certification allows these aircraft to fly on routes that are a certain amount of flying time away from the nearest airport. So that's what that rule is all about. Now, I don't know a lot of the details of these rules because, again, I'm just not familiar with them because I don't fly ETOPS type flights right now in my career. But that was something I didn't know. I didn't realize that in 2007 the FAA had redefined the definition of ETOPS. And now that unless you're a freight carrier, ETOPS is actually something, it's just basically extended operations, and that encompasses all passenger-carrying airliners, two, three, four engine or more. And so there, I hope that answered your question. I'll put a link, if I remember, in the show notes to the Wikipedia article for ETOPS. Okay, and I think that was your last question. And if not, send me some more voice feedback and ask it again. Okay, so I had planned to immediately after this piece of feedback talk about Joe's feedback regarding his paper, but I've already done that. So I can move on now, can I? All right. Hi, Jeff. Firstly, I want to say that I love your show. I'm an Australian, but live in Amsterdam and have averaged about one flight per week over the last 8 years of my job. I'm still as excited to fly today as I was when I was a kid. I sometimes fly Amsterdam to Philly on U.S. Airways. I'm fortunate enough to be able to fly at the front of the plane at each time I fly this leg. There is a seat saved for one of the pilots. About 45 minutes after takeoff, one of the pilots always comes out and sleeps in the seat. It usually goes back about 1 hour before landing. In fact, this week it was closer to 40 minutes before landing. I guess my first question would be simply answered, and that is, yes, it is safe, and there's no need for both pilots to be in the cockpit during the cruising part of the flight. But my second question would be, is the work schedule so hard for these guys that they need to sleep so much? Doesn't seem like they are doing all that much. On Singapore Airlines, there are 3 to 4 pilots, and they never leave the flight deck. What is it like on Acme Airlines for medium to long-haul flights? Keep up the great work, Daniel. Well, Daniel, thank you for your question, and I think that there might be, well, I can tell you this. If there's one pilot that came out of the cockpit of the Amsterdam to Philly flight on U.S. Airways, and it was the same pilot that stayed in that seat the entire time and went back right before landing, I'd say, wow, somebody did something wrong, because that is not supposed to happen. In fact, I would imagine, you probably didn't know it, there were 3 pilots in that cockpit. And the way it works in general, again, I don't fly international, so I don't, I'm not up to speed completely on all these rules, the way they calculate all the breaks and such. But at Acme, on certain length flights, we have one captain and 2 first officers, and one of the first officers is considered a relief pilot. And so before takeoff, during all the pre-flight duties and everything else, all 3 pilots are working to get the flight planned and operated and all the pre-flight checks done and all that kind of stuff. They're in the cockpit for takeoff. And at a certain point after takeoff, one of the pilots goes back to the back, the business class seat that you were talking about, for his or her break. And that usually only lasts for like 2-3 hours, something like that. And then they go back up to the cockpit, and then another pilot comes out for their scheduled rest break. So the three pilots are all alternating breaks. That's the way it's supposed to work. And so it could be that you just didn't, you assumed that the pilot that you were seeing over there in that rest seat was the same pilot the whole time. I bet that you just didn't see the transfer between pilots occupying that seat. So that should have been three different pilots in that seat during that entire flight. And there were at least three pilots on that flight, I'm sure, because I think the FAA requires that. So, and then, of course, the longer range flights, we actually have two full crews. So if a 747 or a 777 or 767, well, I don't know if we use any 767ERs on the super long-haul flights. But in that case, we will put two full crews on, two captains and two first officers. And then they just break down a schedule to have their breaks, you know, 3-4 hour breaks, whatever. And they're rotated around so that everybody has an opportunity to take a rest. As far as the work required, there's a lot of stuff going on up there. You know, don't believe the idea that we go up there, push a button, and we just watch everything happen. That's not true at all. There is a lot of stuff going on, especially the overseas flights. There are clearances, there's constant communications, reports to the company, engine instrument readings, and a lot of things going on. So it's never one of those things where you're just sitting there trying to stay awake because there's nothing going on up there. So yes, there is plenty of work for more than one pilot on an ocean crossing. That's for sure. So yes, it is. There is a need for all of those folks up there. And hope that answered your question regarding that. Again, hey, Jeff, First Officer Jeff Felmuth, and others who are listening to the podcast who routinely do these types of flights, maybe you could chime in to better answer that question than I did for Daniel. And Daniel, thanks again for your feedback. Keep listening and asking questions. Peter Doyle sent this to me. Hey, Captain Jeff, I'm sure you've seen this already, but here it is again. And then he gave me a link. And the link is to kind of an unfortunate incident where a lady, a 56-year-old lady, weighing over 30 stone, I think that's a little over 400 pounds, put on weight during the holiday, had only one leg, and used a wheelchair. She died from health complications in Hungary 9 days after she was kicked off the first of three jets. It's kind of a long story, and there are pictures here, too, and it's really sad. This lady apparently suffers from some kind of health issue, diabetes and some other things, and quite a large woman, 425 pounds, which is 30 stone, 5 pounds. If you look at the pictures of this article, and again, I'll put the link in the show notes, you'll see that she is quite a large woman. In fact, there's one photo where crash fire rescue workers are actually trying to pick up this lady off the ground using a sheet or something, and she's just so big, so heavy, that they can hardly move her. And basically, the reason why she was not allowed on that first flight was that the airline didn't have a seatbelt extender that was large enough for her to use. And, I mean, again, you look at this lady and there's no way she would take up a whole row, like three seats at least, not one seat. And so apparently, I don't want to go into all the details of this, but she was sent to another airline to see if they could get her on board their airliner, and they couldn't accommodate her. And I think the third airline was actually making some headway to get her transported, but by that point, she had suffered a relapse, and she passed away, unfortunately. So, condolences to this lady, and it must have been quite a hard thing for the family to see her kind of suffer this kind of medical condition and then pass away. But it didn't occur because she was on the flight. I think that her death occurred for other reasons. But so I thought I'd mention that. Not really sure what else to say about that, Peter. But thank you for sending me the article. Okay, let's continue here. This might be my last piece of feedback on this marathon podcast. Yeah, I think it is. Captain Jeff, my apologies for not being clear on my last email. I told you about flying to see my in-laws for Thanksgiving. Our final destination was RDM, which you said you were not familiar with. By the way, I did actually look it up after I mentioned it on the last podcast and see that it's Redmond Bend, Oregon. And he continues, that's what it is, Redmond Bend, Oregon, a 3-hour drive southeast from Portland. It's in the high desert in the rain shadow of the Cascades, and it's home to the noted ski resort Mount Bachelor. Bend, the main city, is home to at least 15 different breweries. Yay! Many are craft breweries, and there are a lot of excellent places. The largest is Deschutes Brewing, which you said you had during the last podcast. Yeah, I was in Dallas, and of all places, at our long layover hotel, and was enjoying the, I think it was called the White IPA, and it was delicious. Deschutes Brewing in Bend, Oregon. During our last trip, I made my first venture to a place called Crux Fermentation Project, which was outstanding. I highly recommend it, or maybe that's Crux, C-R-U-X, I'm not sure. I'm going to pronounce it Crux, but it's probably Crew or something like that. I highly recommend it to my fellow listeners, as well as the Deschutes Brewing, which has a large restaurant in downtown Bend. Hope this finds you well, and keep up the great work. Love, love, love your podcast. Thanks. And Brian, I love, love, love your feedback. Keep sending it in. Appreciate it. And he is the Brian from Northern Virginia. So he's one of my many Brians amongst the many Chris's in my feedback crew. So thanks again for sending that in and clarifying what RDM is, and love to join you for a beer sometime. All right, that's going to do it. Again, I apologize that I didn't get the podcast out sooner than I did, and because of that, this was a super long episode again. And I hope to have one out next week, so keep listening. Hope everybody's enjoying their holiday season. While I'm recording this, it's actually now Thursday morning. I had to stop recording last night for the wonderful dinner that my sister fixed, and met with my nephew and my sister's boyfriend. We had a great time, and I just didn't. It just got too late for me to continue recording the rest of this podcast last night. So I'm looking through my soundboard here to make sure I haven't forgotten anybody, as far as feedback is concerned. No, I think I got everybody. So with that, let me head over to my last item on my script, so to speak. And that's what I say at the end. You too. Yes, you listening can send feedback by sending it to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com. You can call my Google Voice number 304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. Or better yet, send voicemail by clicking on the Send Voicemail tab on the Airline Pilot Guy or CatholicPilot.com website. And if you have one of those fancy smartphones or tablets or whatever that has a microphone on it, they do a really awesome job of recording feedback. So use that thing and just mail it to feedback@AirlinePilotGuy.com. On Facebook, I'm Captain Jeff, and I also have a page there, Airline Pilot Guy page. So just go to Facebook and do a search for Airline Pilot Guy, all one word. And sometimes I put out some tweets. You can find me at Airline Pilot Guy there, or Jeff Nielsen. That's my real name. Excuse me. And let's see. Stitcher Radio. You can listen to me on Stitcher in your car. A lot of cars now, modern cars, have Stitcher Radio as part of their package. So do a search for Airline Pilot Guy on Stitcher Smart Radio. That's on-demand news, talk, and more on your mobile phone, your cars, your Android phones, your iPads, and all those fancy devices. Downloading is easy. Just go to Stitcher.com. That's STITCHER.com/Airline Pilot. And or you can go to your app store and download the Stitcher Smart Radio app. Stitcher Smart Radio is the smarter way to listen to radio. And until next time, wishing you clear skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care and God bless.
Good day.